This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The job of a military chaplain serving in a war zone goes well beyond conducting religious rituals and offering spiritual counseling. Soldiers are beset by stress, exhaustion, fear, loneliness, and all too often the pain of losing friends in combat. A unit's chaplain is frequently the person a young soldier turns to for counseling and comfort. Our guest, Father John Barkmeyer, was pastor of a parish on Chicago's South Side before deciding to become an Army chaplain in 2003, the year U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq. There's a shortage of Catholic priests in the Army, and for much of his current tour in Iraq, Father Barkmeyer has been the only Catholic chaplain in the province of Anbar. I spoke to Father Barkmeyer recently when he was in Chicago for a brief R&R break. He left for Iraq today to complete his 15-month tour of duty. Well, Father Barkmeyer, welcome to Fresh Air. You were a civilian until 2003, is that right?
Correct, yes.
What got you into military service?
Well, I primarily was a pastor in the southwest side of Chicago, and a lot of the kids in the parish were volunteering for service, and especially between the Army and the Marines. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about supporting our troops, and, you know, most of that revolved around putting, you know, a yellow ribbon around on the bumper of your car and things like that. And I realized that there was a tremendous shortage of Catholic priests in the armed forces, and it was something that I could do that could be meaningful for lots of soldiers, Marines, sailors, and airmen. So because of that, I think that really piqued my interest and my curiosity, and that's what started the process.
Now, if I understand, you were the only Catholic chaplain in the Anbar province of Iraq. Is that right?
The only Army Catholic chaplain, correct.
Right.
There are a couple of Navy priests in the area, but I'm the only Army chaplain.
So give me a sense of how you minister to that many soldiers. How big the area is, how much you have to move around where you're stationed.
Sure. Okay. Probably the two principal things that I do. One is traveling from location to location, celebrating the mass worship services for guys. And the big challenge there is transportation. Trying to get anywhere is a major deal. The first thing is because you always have to travel in convoy. And normally it's convoy of at least 4 gun trucks. You may have anywhere between 12 to 15 personnel. So trying to get those kind of resources is very difficult. It's also then, depending on the area where you're traveling, you know, it can be fairly dangerous, too. My second week at Ramadi, my Humvee was hit by an IED, a roadside bomb. And so, you know, that certainly got my attention. And it's always a little bit of a challenge and always kind of wondering, anytime you leave the wire, anytime you go outside the gate of the camp, you know, what's going to happen? So transportation, traveling to the different combat outposts, and the different bases or forward operating bases or FOBs is a significant part of the experience.
You said you travel around to a lot of forward areas and you hold mass there. How do you physically manage that? I mean, where do you conduct mass in a forward area?
you conduct mass, you know, any place you can. The combat outposts tend to be like a building that the Army or the Marines will have taken over, fortified with sandbags, with blast walls and guard posts and things like that. The inside, of course, it's a very austere situation. There's never, you know, running water. At best, you've got electricity. So when it comes to saying mass, you say mass in any nook and cranny you can. What I use for an altar depends. You know, you can pop out the windshield, the bulletproof windshield on a Humvee, turn that upside down, put it on a couple of gas cans, and, you know, I've said mass on that. I've frequently, probably most often, I've said masses on litters, so on stretchers, just because it happens to be a flat surface. But you think about the symbolism of that. You know, these are stretchers that have, you know, no doubt carried injured, wounded, sometimes dead soldiers, and here I am, you know, celebrating the sacrifice of the mass and using that as the altar, and it's powerful and it's symbolic, and I don't think the soldiers miss that. You know, I think they understand that intuitively.
Now, as a priest, I assume you hear confessions also in forward areas.
I do, right. So, yes.
And how do you manage that physically?
Well, you go anywhere that's private. So sometimes you have to, you know, wander around a little bit and find a corner of a lot, corner of the building. But, you know, when a soldier says, you know, hey, can you hear my confession? You know, it's going to be something important. And you do whatever you can to, you know, to accommodate that and certainly to ensure confidentiality and privacy.
Well, I know that you served, that you spent a lot of years, you know, as a priest in I guess, the south side of Chicago. Are the confessions of soldiers in a war zone distinct from the confessions of civilians?
Oh, boy, they absolutely are. It's frequently, you know, life and death type stuff. The impact of having to kill another person, you know, even though it's clearly a combat environment, clearly something that, you know, under the just war tradition it would be morally justified, it still tears apart a human being. I just don't believe we're made to do that. You know, we don't do that naturally. We don't do that instinctually. And so having had those experiences of killing another person makes you think, you know, in terms of, hey, you know, what am I doing? What does God want me to do? It becomes all the more tragic when the individual realizes that it was a civilian that they killed inadvertently. It becomes devastating. And so it's very, very different. The confessions are very different than in civilian life.
And, I mean, I guess part of what you do in that role is prescribe penance. Do I have that right?
Correct, yes. Yes, penance. You know, oftentimes we would ask the soldier, the Marine, to, you know, to pray for the individual that they killed or wounded, or to pray, you know, pray for themselves, to ask for healing, you know, from God. But that's an important part of the sacrament.
Catholic soldiers have the option of, when you come by, requesting a confession and can share these troubling thoughts. I'm sure a great many of the soldiers you meet are not Catholic. Do they approach you, or are there venues, are there ways for them to seek the comfort and guidance that you might give them?
You know, absolutely. The chaplains in the armed forces are the only folks that can offer complete confidentiality. So if somebody speaks to a chaplain, and this is regardless of their particular denomination or faith tradition, the conversations they have with chaplains are 100% confidential. And the Army does that because the military does that in order to give them a safe venue, a place to vent, a place to say things that they need to say that they couldn't otherwise. It becomes difficult for chaplains because, you know, sometimes a soldier might say, I'm planning on killing myself, you know, and there's nothing you can do. You know, so as a chaplain, I've been put into a lot of uncomfortable situations. But the overall good—
Have you been told that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And boy, that's tough. So, I mean, I work with the individual as much as possible. What I'd like to, you know, would certainly like to be able to do would be to go to their first sergeant or company commander and say, hey, you know, look, this is the issue. We need to put them under suicide watch and so forth. But you just can't break confidentiality, and that's not easy.
Gosh, that must be a burden for you to carry.
It is. It is. You know, you're wondering, you know, I wake up some days and the first thing I do is check up on a soldier. Is this guy still around? Is he okay? So it's not easy. It's, you know, it serves the ultimate good for the soldiers, but, you know, in order for them to be able to talk through the issues that they need to talk through in a safe, confidential environment. But it does come at a price.
Well, you know, in the civilian world, a counselor has a private office and someone can make an appointment and do that without their peers knowing that they're doing it, you know, if they want to keep it private. I mean, how do you enable that in a combat setting?
Well, I'll tell you what, being deployed is like living in a fishbowl. You know, there's very little privacy. I do have my separate room, so I do counseling in my own in my private room, and that gives people at least physically a place to go. But what frequently will happen is it might take place over the course of walking with somebody, sitting down at a meal, and I guess people around, they know what's going on. They may not know the subject of, you know, what's being discussed in the counseling, but, you know, they realize, hey, this guy's talking to a chaplain, and, you know, they look like they've got a pretty serious expression on their faces. They know what's going on. And that's, I guess that's part of being in military life is you don't have that privacy. You don't have that type of, those types of outlets you have in the civilian world. Everybody tends to be in everybody else's business. And that's, once again, that's probably why the confidentiality aspect that chaplains can offer is so important, because at least what's said remains a secret.
You know, the battlefield cliche is that there are no atheists in foxholes. Have you found that soldiers who come to war without any strong religious beliefs take more of an interest in spirituality?
Absolutely. Whether somebody has a strong religious tradition or someone has almost nothing, almost everyone begins asking the questions. You know, what's the meaning, the purpose of my life? You know, is there a God? Does he care? How do I get connected with God? So, for example, I've baptized a lot of individuals, much more so in the range between, you know, maybe 19 to 25-year-olds than I would have done as a pastor in Chicago.
Do you ever find that some soldiers who have had a religious background, when they get to a war zone and are surrounded by cruelty and carnage, lose their faith?
I think lots of folks ask, you know, where in the world is God in the midst of this? And that's a absolutely legitimate question. You know, you look for good when confronted with devastation, destruction, and death, and you look for good and you look for it, and some days you'll go weeks without seeing any. And I think guys ask that question frequently. And then I try to remind them, you know, what's going on in your life? Describe it. And then, you know, maybe it's a soldier that's been kind of adopted an Iraqi family and looked out for their kids, you know, said, well, look, the presence of God is in those kids, and you're making a difference in their lives. It's a matter of pointing out maybe some of the more subtle signs of hope in the midst of something that can be pretty bleak.
One of the things that must be difficult for you to do is to administer last rites to a soldier who has been wounded.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very difficult. You know, when we first came to the section of Iraq, Ramadi, it was considered by many the most dangerous city on the face of the earth. We would have mass casualties two or three times a week, with the in-between days being filled in with, you know, soldiers, civilians being wounded and so forth. But you'd have mass casualty of 20, 30 people dead, 50 people wounded or so, just all the time, and it became normative. But when soldiers were critically wounded, and no matter how frequently you see it, it always grabs at your heart. You realize, you know, hey, this kid—he's 19 years old, he's 20 years old, and he's never going to see his parents again. You know, this is going to be his last day on the face of the earth. It's just a painful, difficult thing to do. In some ways, it's very beautiful. I mean, it's the most beautiful thing you can do is to just reassure them of God's love, God's care, God's compassion at the time in their life where they need it most. So it's beautiful, but it's difficult.
It must be hard to appreciate the beauty at that moment.
Oh, yeah. You have to do that on reflection. You know, you try to be there with the person. If it's holding his hand, if it's stroking his forehead, you try to provide comforting words for him, a smile, whatever it is that you can. But it's difficult.
And because of what you do, are you somebody who rushes to the scene of every mass casualty event? Or
right. As long as I'm on the FOB, the forward operating base, I'll go to Charlie Med, the hospital. You know, obviously I can't do that if I'm out at the different combat outposts. But right, any mass casualty, we head directly down to Charlie Med. Now, if it's a mass casualty, and frequently what happens now, more often than not, is it involves exclusively Iraqi civilians or Iraqi police and army. In which case, you know, I'll be present there, but I certainly want to respect their Islamic traditions. So I don't, you know, obviously I don't offer any particular Christian rites, but I'll you know, hold their hand, smile, maybe talk to them through an interpreter. If some of them have been mortally wounded, I'll be with them, you know, as they die, just so they have somebody there.
You know, I know from looking at some of the dispatches that you've written about your experience that there is a ritual that accompanies the transportation of bodies of servicemen back to the United States. Can you describe that?
Oh, yes. We call them hero flights. So if a soldier has been killed, their bodies will be taken to a morgue, depending on where it can be, a kind of a makeshift building. And within that, the body's then prepared, at least somewhat, for helicopter flight that will take the remains to Kuwait, and then from Kuwait to Dover Air Force Base in the States. So when it's a soldier's been killed and is we're making arrangements for his hero flight, we'll put the body into the body bag, kind of go through the pockets and for identification, for personal belongings, personal effects, to make sure that it's recorded so that it travels with him. We'll then transfer the body onto a litter. There's an American flag with a light that's shining on it in the back of the morgue. About 20 minutes before the helicopter arrives, we'll have his closest friends, his buddies, we'll invite them into the morgue. We'll say a prayer. Then we'll ask the guys to line up and to be his litter bearers. And there's usually, you know, anywhere 50, 100, 200 soldiers that will be lining the path to the ambulance. Once the body is taken to the ambulance, I'll say another prayer for everyone gathered, and then we'll slowly process to the helipad. We open up the doors to the ambulance. His buddies once again will carry his remains and load him onto the helicopter. There's a final salute, and as the helicopter takes off, it's really touching and powerful and beautiful and painful all at once.
You know, I have to say, I can hear the emotion in your voice as you.
Yeah,
relive
you know,
this.
I'm as I'm talking about this, I'm replaying, you know, the event that I've experienced over and over again, and I do get a little choked up.
In this job as an Army chaplain, I mean, you are helping these troops with, you know, they're experiencing fear and stress and loneliness and often the pain of loss, and yet you're facing all that same stuff too. Where do you turn for support and comfort?
You know, I've got some great friends that I've made since being deployed, some other chaplains. There are a couple of priest friends back in the Chicagoland area that I email regularly. And I do that consciously for my own sanity, because you're right. You know, I do experience most everything, you know, all the other guys are experiencing. And I certainly have to go somewhere with it, and it has to be, you know, safe. It has to be appropriate. And so I do have those channels, and I take advantage of it because it's important. And, you know, when times are stressful, I need that as much as any of the other soldiers.
And I wonder if in some ways it might be harder because you're carrying a piece of their pain with you as well as your own.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. Anything that goes on in a soldier's life, I guess clinically it'd be ideal if you could completely separate yourself and look at somebody objectively. But, you know, these are the guys that you serve with. These are the guys you have meals with. These are the guys you joke around with. These are the guys you walk through all sorts of different experiences of their lives and your life. And you do this together. And so... So when they're hurting, it does become, it becomes, you know, the chaplain's pain too.
I wondered if I could ask you to kind of focus on a couple of moments, and if you can think of them, that'll be helpful. And if you can't, I would understand. But maybe one moment that tells us what's hard about your role, and maybe another that tells us what's rewarding about it.
Both hard and rewarding. Those are great questions. You know, there was an interesting experience in the Al Anbar province where I'm stationed. There has been a dramatic improvement in terms of the security situation, and that took place not so much because of the U.S. Armed Forces, but because the local sheikhs have banded together and decided to take back their province, and they formed a council called the Anbar Awakening. The head of that was a sheikh, Abu Risa. And he was kind of the charismatic leader of this group. Just recently, about, I guess, 6 weeks, maybe 2 months ago, he was killed in a car bomb attack. Now, he lived just outside of our base. And so when the explosion took place, of course, we all saw it. It was, you know, it was one of the smaller explosions. And any time that happened, you know, you wonder, well, who just died? But having lost him... When we found out that it was him, it was, you know, it was hard because, you know, here's a guy who's, if this thing in Iraq works, it's going to be largely because of his willingness to take a gamble, his willingness to offer leadership. You know, it's in some extent, it's being duplicated in different areas of Iraq now. And it would be almost the equivalent for the United States of losing a founding father. And actually, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, I'm still alive largely because of the stance this guy took. with the amount of violence that was taking place, there's no way that I could do as much, the amount of traveling that I've done without being seriously wounded or killed. You know, if I was, you know, hit by a IED 2 weeks into it, you know, you're not going to make it through a 15-month deployment without a serious injury or being killed. You know, so his death, I think, was something that I took hard because he's done so much for the people of Iraq, and it's a sign of hope. So that's one piece that I'd say that maybe in an unusual way that's difficult.
We're speaking with Father John Barkmeyer. He's just finished 10 months in Iraq as an army chaplain and will be returning to Iraq soon. You've described how you have these encounters with soldiers who really need help and support and counseling. I'm wondering, farther up the chain of command, what do commanders think of you and your fellow chaplains?
Well, time and time again, you know, they'll express their gratitude because in one way, we keep a lot of bad things off their plate. You know, by being able to deal with things on our level, we deal with a lot of situations that they never become aware of. So if things are running smoothly, you know, if something's happening, you know, chances are a lot of, you know, crises have been averted. You know, people are finding successful ways of dealing with the different challenges in their lives. But I've been very, very impressed with the support from the commanders. And that's really been across the board.
Yeah, what kinds of crisis do you avert? What kinds of problems do you save them?
Well, you know, here's a typical example that's just devastating for a soldier. Their spouse back home is cheating on them. Well, you think of what happens. They're 7,000 miles away. They are powerless. They can't go back home. They can't fix anything. You know, their vows of marriage have been shattered. They're devastated, you know. And the next day, they got to go back out on mission. You know, they got to put their life on the line. They've got to be aware. They got to be alert, not only to keep them alive, but to keep their buddies alive, you know. And so they got some real significant demands that are placed on them. Their head's not in the game. You know, how could they be? And this happens much more frequently than I would have ever imagined. So those types of things, you know, you work with somebody, you let them talk through it, you give them some coping strategies, and in a sense, you try to patch them up so they can go out and do their job tomorrow. Because regardless, they're going to have to go out and do their job tomorrow. You know, there's in the Army, you don't get a day off, you don't get breaks. The expectation is you have to show up because chances are there's nobody to take your place. So those types of things, you know, that would be a very typical role, something that a chaplain would do regularly, especially in a deployed environment.
You know, you said earlier that you went into the military ministry in part because so many people from your own parish had gone to serve. I don't know if you're comfortable answering this question, but I wonder how you feel about the war.
Well, you know, publicly, probably 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the initial invasion, you know, I at Mass during the homily, you know, I said, I made three points, two of which I said, you know, I looking at the what's offered as intelligence for the existence of weapons of mass destruction, I said, it does not look credible, you know, especially to justify, you know, an invasion. I also said another thing that's being touted is the connection to Al-Qaeda. But the evidence that's being presented is flimsy at best, and certainly something that you can't justify, you know, launching an invasion for. And so, you know, my feelings have been pretty consistent throughout, you know, in terms of getting into the war. I think, you know, my role as a chaplain, I guess it doesn't matter why we're in war because my role is taking care of the guys. So regardless of my personal feelings, I'm there for the soldiers. That's, you know, that's what I do. I've certainly had, you know, lots of questions every day, you know, that I'm serving, and especially serving, you know, overseas in Iraq. I also realize now, as much as I do believe we have to begin a slow, carefully planned withdrawal to give Iraqis ownership, I realize this is their country. The problems ultimately are going to have to be solved by them. So I do believe we do have to begin a phased withdrawal. But we are now, we're morally responsible for what happened. We created this situation. And as much as I'd like to pull everybody out today, morally I just don't think we can. We have to continue to work, you know, with the situation to give the people of Iraq the best possible chance of salvaging their country and salvaging their lives.
Well, Father Barkmeyer, I wish you a safe tour when you return to Iraq, and I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Father John Barkmeyer is an Army chaplain. He returned to Iraq today to complete his 15-month tour of duty.